When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Academic Life. This is a podcast for your academic journey and beyond. I'm the show's producer and the show host, Dr. Christina Gessler, and today I'm joined by Dr. Isabella Rossner, the author of the new book, Stitching Freedom, Embroidery, and Incarceration, which considers how for centuries, people have stitched in good times and in bad, finding strength in the needle moving in and out of fabric. Stitching Freedom explores the embroidery made in prisons and mental health hospitals by those who have embroidered to distract, to reflect, or to calm. From Mary Queen of Scots to Lorena Bulwer to Annie Parker, Dr. Rossner unpicks embroidered histories to discover what can be created when freedom is out of reach. We also dive into her new article, With Her Own Hair, a Victorian Prisoner's Art, which takes a peek inside Stitching Freedom by zeroing in on unfortunate Annie Parker. Welcome to the show, Dr. Rossner.
Thank you so much for having me. I am thrilled to be here.
I am so glad you're here and we get to talk about your fascinating work and your expertise. Before we dive into that, though, will you please tell us about yourself?
Sure. Okay. I am the curator of the Royal School of Needlework and a research consultant at Whitney Antiques, which is Britain's largest collection and stock of antique needlework from between the 17th and 19th centuries. So I am clearly American, but I live in London. I just finished my PhD at King's College London, where I studied Quaker women's needlework, waxwork, and shellwork before 1800. And just generally, I'm an embroidery gal. I guess I would call myself a textile historian. So I'm really passionate about studying all parts of the human experience as told through textiles, and in particular, embroidery.
That leads to my next question, which is, what got you into this field?
That's a good question. And it's kind of a long answer, but I'll try to keep it short. So I grew up in Los Angeles loving period dramas. I was told by an English teacher to read one classic novel a month. And I started reading Little Women and Jane Austen, and it just unleashed something in me. And so I started watching the adaptations of those books. I spent all of my weekends watching miniseries, and I got really into historical dress from there. When I was in college, I need to switch to not say university because I'm so used to saying that here in the UK. After my first year of college, I interned at the Nantucket Historical Association, and I did that because they had a decorative arts internship. And I was tasked with working at a place called the 1800 House, where they taught adults historical arts and crafts classes. When I was there, I was told by an amazing woman named Edie Bourdier about Nantucket samplers. Samplers being basically embroidery practice made by frequently girls, young girls and teenaged girls over the course of centuries. It was the way they learned various embroidery stitches and practiced those to perfection. She told me that you can identify a Nantucket sampler based on a single tree motif that appears on almost all of them. And that blew my mind. I had always considered historical dress, but had not really considered textiles. I was interested in dress because I cared about normal people who were like me and how they made their lives rich and interesting and how they clothed themselves. But I didn't realize until then that textiles were just as much, if not even more, involved in self-fashioning and adorning one's body and home. And Edie Borier telling me about that Nantucket tree motif just blew my mind and led to me thinking deeply about textiles and embroidery in particular, in order to understand that embroidery is frequently a way for us to get to know girls and women who are largely absent from the historical record. So it was basically that one conversation about trees as they appear in embroidery that led me on my life's journey. That sounds dramatic, but it's true. From there, I was lucky enough to intern at a variety of museums and do a lot of curatorial work with textiles and embroidery in particular. So it's been a very straight and narrow path, but it has surprised me every step of the way.
For listeners, Nantucket is an island way off the coast of Massachusetts, about 30 miles out at sea, and I lived on it for 5 years.
Did you?
I did. And I'm curious, did you get to do a fairly deep dive into their archival collection of samplers? They have some fascinating pieces.
They have some amazing pieces. And I was able to look at a few, but it was really early days for my interest in that particular thing. But what was super important for me being there was, well, so I was tasked with creating a quilting course at the 1800 house. And doing that research suddenly led to me learning about the Nantucket School of Needlery, which was a really historically important needlework school education course held on Nantucket. And it was oftentimes a distance learning course. And it led me to learn about Erica Wilson, who was an English woman who was educated at the Royal School of Needlework, who moved to the United States and basically became the Julia Child of embroidery. She ended up having a TV show about how to stitch on PBS. She produced a bunch of books. She was very much at the forefront of this movement to make embroidery relevant and exciting again, especially for women in the home in the 20th century. So when I found out about that stuff, that is kind of what led to the whole journey. I was then able to look at some of their samplers and other sorts of decorative arts that are held in that collection, which is an amazing collection. And funnily enough, I could not have envisioned this. When writing my PhD thesis, Nantucket has several very important Quaker samplers. And even though I wasn't looking at New England Quakerhood, I ended up including several examples of samplers from the NHA because they were very, very relevant to my work. So between those samplers appearing in my dissertation and me now being at the Royal School of Needlework where Erica Wilson was taught, it all feels kind of wonderfully and almost spookily full circle.
It's amazing how stories in hindsight make sense, but in real time, we say a lot of things like, I don't know, I think I'll give it a try, or it's an opportunity, I think I'll see what's there.
Yeah, it's actually quite crazy, all of the coincidences, but you're right, it has been mostly just me saying, why not? Or that looks interesting, over and over again for forever.
So now you have your job as a curator. Can you take us inside that a bit, and then we'll dive into your piece with her own hair.
Sure. So I work at the Royal School of Needlework, which is an organization based in Hampton Court Palace, just outside of London here in England. And it was founded 152 years ago and is now considered to be the center of excellence for hand embroidery. I was hired to digitize and catalog the RSN's very sizable collection of textiles. We have at least 10,000 objects spanning more than 1,000 years, but nobody really knows about it because it's always been kind of hidden in the palace. It hasn't been publicly accessible before. So my job is to catalog and photograph and make publicly available every object in the collection. So my first role, I only started in June, which is actually almost a year ago now, but it's still early days. So my first job is to create the first 100, which is a group of 100 objects, as well as some items from the archive that are representative of the Royal School of Needlework's breadth and depth of their collection. And so that will be going online in the spring around Easter. And it means that people will be able to go to the website and look at all of these objects, get really deep into the detail of various pictures of them, look at all of their stitches. We are writing thorough descriptions. It's going to be, I think, a really, really exciting opportunity for people who are interested in textiles to learn more about this collection that very, very few people know to exist. So alongside that, I'm also working on curating some small shows, both at the RSN and of RSN objects at different locations. It's all about making people aware that we have an amazing collection. It's very vast in terms of time and place, and it connects to a lot of objects in other museum collections. So I'm just really excited to be involved, really.
It's such a fascinating art form, and yet so many of us stumble across it. It's almost hidden in plain sight because the samplers were often framed and put on the walls. They were gifts. They took so long to make that it was visible, at least to your familiars, that you were making it. Why do you think we have to keep rediscovering this art form?
That's a good question, and it's something I think about a lot. I think it has to do with embroidery's mixture of gender and race and class. So, of course, many of us are familiar with this idea of art versus craft and the oftentimes very frustrating and unfortunate hierarchy that puts paintings and sculpture and architecture at a higher level than things like ceramics or silver or tapestry or embroidery. And that has to do with Vasari, a Renaissance author, 500 years ago, more than that even, kind of creating, I don't think he could have imagined his impact, but he wrote a book where he poised all of these artists as geniuses, as individual geniuses, and that shifted us away from this idea of valuing guilds and workshops. It's all a bit of a mess, but basically I think that one of the reasons why embroidery is oftentimes forgotten about is because it is largely the work of often anonymous girls and women. It's often the work of normal, I say that in quotation marks, you know, non-wealthy, non-elite girls and women. It's so that together, I think, are two factors that unfortunately work against it. But additionally, embroidery and textiles more generally are so universal. They're everywhere. We see them all the time. We're both wearing loads of textiles right now. We're probably sitting on some textiles. We're surrounded all the time. And I think that the ubiquitous nature of it means that people forget that it's special and significant, and that there has for centuries, millennia even, been immense amounts of labor dedicated to the creation of textiles. So I think that when you said earlier that it's hidden in plain sight, you're correct. I think that people forget the value of these things because they're all around us.
I was thinking back to something you said earlier that you needed to teach a class on quilting. And I remembered in grad school, I worked at a small museum and they wanted me to teach a class on quilting. And I was very honest that I don't sew and I can't cut in a straight line. And I definitely have never made a quilt. And they said, well, Christina, you will figure it out. And so I put on an entire workshop really just by being good at giving very clear directions. And everybody made, you know, small lap quilts. And I was just thrilled for them and, you know, praising them. I just thought it was amazing. And none of them believed that I can't sew. I can't thread a needle. I mean, I cannot do any of this. And so I come at it with just complete awe that anyone can do this. And just how incredibly intricate this work is and that any of it has survived is such a testament to how well crafted it is.
I agree. I think that, well, it's interesting that you don't know how to sew, but you taught this very successful quilting course, because one thing I forgot to say in my previous comment about why do we need to keep rediscovering this is that tied to the ubiquitous nature of textile is its accessibility. So all you really need is a needle, a thread, and a piece of fabric, and you can really go from there. There's not a lot of gatekeeping when it comes to embroidery or textiles more generally. And I think that also how accessible it is means that people forget that it is oftentimes very special. It doesn't have the same, oftentimes for most people, it doesn't have the same awe factor as something like a painting does, because most people need to go to universities to learn to paint, to academies to, you know, learn to paint like the old masters, whereas embroidery and textiles are about learning from other people. Oftentimes now people are, you know, going to YouTube, and it's about finding your own style. So I think that that's one of the reasons why people forget about it as well. It's that it's not, the building blocks are not particularly special. But you're right, there is so much labor in all of these pieces. And even when there's not a lot of labor, there's always clearly so much love. I like embroidery so very much because I think that it's oftentimes a really good genealogical document. So with a sampler, for example, you will frequently get a girl's name, her age, the date, perhaps her location, a teacher's name, a favorite color, a verse. You have all of this information to piece together a girl's whole life, even if you can't find her in the genealogical records. You have a really good idea of where and when she was and what materials she had available to her and what did her stitching look like, and was she stitching in a dark room or did she have lots of natural light? You know, there are all of these little very rich details of the human experience that you can glean from studying a piece of embroidery. And embroidery, each stitch is like a brush stroke. I think that people don't often realize that there is a person and personality within every single stitch in a piece of embroidery.
And I've had the opportunity to observe people do embroidery, and they have these very fine, tiny little scissors, and you can see them furiously cutting out a stitch, which to a layperson such as myself looks lovely, and it does not meet their standards. There's such a high quality of work done, partly because these women who made these things held themselves to such a high standard, the way any artist would. It has to look as close to what they're imagining it should as possible, or it won't do.
I think that's a really interesting observation, and oftentimes a correct one. So yes, you frequently get people who are very exacting in their work, who need something to look perfect. But I like also how frequently we get embroidery that is not perfect, that really shows somebody's personality and what they were going through emotionally that day. So There's this image or a few images of samplers that go around online every so often on Twitter/X and on Instagram. And they frequently are what looks to be a sampler. And it says something like, Edith Ann made this in 1848 and hated every stitch. It always says something like that. And I get so annoyed because they're deeply, deeply not correct. They're not accurate. They are 1990s weird home goods versions of samplers, and they do a lot to perpetuate myths about sampler making and embroidery more generally. But I find those pieces very interesting because they're trying to capture something that embroidery often keeps pretty secret, and that is how somebody feels when they're making it. So I feel that I've looked at enough embroidery to be able to get a sense of someone's education and circumstances and even possibly their kind of emotional landscape when I look at a piece of historical embroidery. But almost never do we get that clear thing of Edith Ann telling us she hated every stitch. That doesn't exist. When you think about the history of embroidery, especially in places like the United States and Europe, which is primarily where embroidery was, I'm going to re-say that. When you look at the embroidery, the history of embroidery from the United States and from Europe, and so much of it is centered around girls getting an education, a very thorough needlework education in order to be successful wives and mothers and house, you know, managers of households, those artworks, those pieces don't allow for a lot of room in which for girls to tell us how they feel. You're not going to be sitting in a classroom writing on your essay, in your essay, like, I hate this, I want to get out of here, if you want a good grade. That is just not what you're going to be doing, which means that that's what's happening with samplers, with embroidery domestically more generally. You're not seeing people stitching into their samplers, this is the worst, I hate this. They are stitching verses about piety and what it means to be a good daughter and what it means to be a good friend and godly woman and wife and mother. You are not fully seeing what they're feeling as they're stitching. That is absent, but we can get glimpses of that through stitch. It's just that it doesn't rest on the surface as much. Embroidery requires us to dig a bit deeper into who these people were and the circumstances in which they made their objects.
I researched 19th century diaries, and the terms I would use for that would be mapping and decoding.
Ooh, yes, yes.
Are there terms in art history that would specifically describe what you're talking about?
I think that I would use the term deciphering, but I also talk frequently about codes and code breaking and code making. I just recently published a book about a small scale book about the history of embroidery and incarceration called Stitching Freedom. And that is a theme that comes up a lot when you consider the history of embroidery and incarceration, of people stitching in places like prisons and workhouses and mental health hospitals. There is a lot of code making going on, a lot of creating kind of secret languages, not through letters, but through kind of symbols and circumstance and a mixture of those two things. I'm just going to tell you my favorite example. So one of my favorite pieces ever is this sampler made by a British prisoner of war named Alexis T. Castagli. And he was in a prisoner of war camp in Germany in World War II. And he taught himself how to cross stitch. He stole a sweater from another prisoner of war and unraveled it to create threads. And he made this sampler that looks on the surface to be incredibly innocent. It has all of these kind of national symbols of those countries fighting in the war. And it looks really normal. And he writes his name and where he is and the year, December 1941. And in this border around his inscription is Morse code. And the Morse code says over and over again, God save the king and fuck Hitler. Sorry for the curse. I love that because that's a really very obvious example of somebody using embroidery for code. So very frequently we have people embroidering their stories through quote unquote codes in ways that they may not even have been intending to be codes. But then other times you have people actually using stitch to kind of put the middle finger up to whatever they're fighting against. And I like very much that embroidery has the capacity to tell that variety of stories. It tells us, sometimes we get stories about people who are very clearly telling us their motivation and their circumstances and what they're going through. And then other times you have to kind of work to put the pieces together. You have to do some of your own deciphering.
As we've laid the background for this article we're going to discuss, we've talked about the code of the tree and now embedding Morse code. In this piece with her own hair, there's a code of literally her own hair. Can you take us inside Annie Parker's life and what her textile art means?
Absolutely. So Annie Parker was an English woman. She lived in what was at the time Kent, but is now southeast London in the area around Deptford and Lewisham. And she lived in the 19th century. She was born in approximately 1848. And she died at 38 years old, unfortunately, of consumption. And Annie's life was very, very bad, unfortunate. She lived in a dire set of circumstances. We don't know very much about her early years. We know from newspaper records that her father did not survive and she had a bad mom. We know that she was highly educated. But by the end of her life, we know that she was arrested for drunkenness more than 400 times. And she spent years of her life in prison. She spent her time in Maidstone Prison and in Bedford, Maidstone Jail and Bedford Jail. And when she was in those jails, she started to embroider with her hair. And she made samplers. She made at least one pincushion. And I think I now know of 9 pieces of hers that survive, and there are probably more out there. And as she sat in prison embroidering with her own hair, she would then give these objects as gifts to people in the kind of incarceration system, the chaplain of a prison, the guard of another, that sort of thing. And she is frequently in the newspaper kind of selection of London and Kent at the time. She is very much mythologized. She is oftentimes referred to by just her first name, Unfortunate Annie. She is always kind of quoted as having conversations with the various people in the penal system, asking for a lighter sentence or saying, hey, I just got out. Do I have to go back? That sort of thing. She had such a hard life in addition to her addiction. She clearly was having suicidal thoughts, and she attempted to take her own life at least once. She did a lot of ripping of her own clothes while in prison. A newspaper article tells us that she gave birth to 4 children in prison, all of whom died. And we know now, it's, I think, for me at least, a fairly recent discovery that she was married to a man named Thomas and that he was very much abusive. And I'm currently trying to piece together if that was the start of her hair work embroidery journey, or if she was already embroidering before his death, because the earliest sampler that's dated from her that I know of comes from January of 1879, right after he's died. And it says, in memory of Thomas Parker. So I'm trying to, there are lots of pieces that I need to put together, but basically we know a lot about Annie Parker because of the newspaper articles that are written about her, but that's really difficult because they really mythologize her and perpetuate this idea of Annie as a legend, you know, as a Southeast London legend, as nothing more than a drunk. She's listed as having no home, no occupation, and no friends. That's a very, very sad life. So it's important for me to look beyond those sensationalizing stories and to see who she actually was outside of the penal system, and to see what her life was like before it was cut short because of illness. Her art is incredibly powerful. So as she is embroidering her samplers, she is stitching on bleached linen. She is using her own hair, and occasionally she is using other pieces of thread. There are little bits of red thread, green, brown, and she is crocheting around all of her samplers and pincushions borders. They're very, very decorative pieces, and they involve incredibly fine stitching. Hair is hard to work with when it comes to embroidery because it's, brittle is not the right word, but it's not as flexible as a normal piece of thread. It's also much, much finer, and it just doesn't offer the same kind of malleability as a normal piece of embroidery thread. Her text that she embroiders in hair is so precise. You can just tell that she had indeed a very thorough needlework education and that she is using these skills even in the most dire of circumstances. She is clearly very pious. We see that in her embroidery as well. She is only stitching hymns, rhyming verses about heaven, and you know, there are all these kind of very mournful rhyming hymns about how lonely she is. Her friends are no longer near. Despite all of this stuff, thy will be done is what she stitches the most. So it really all paints a picture of a woman who received a very good education, who had fallen victim to an addiction out of her control, who lived in a society that was not really equipped to help her, and who sought comfort through stitch, even in the face of the national media really sensationalizing her every move.
We also know from her embroidery that she was literate. and that she likely had memorized these pieces. It's unlikely, isn't it, that she had access to materials to quote directly from. She would have been recalling these from having learned them some amount of time earlier.
I would think so. And I think frequently about the pace of embroidery. Embroidery is a very, very slow art. It takes a long time to stitch every letter. And the fact that she is choosing stitch for this, to me, suggests an extra level of piety, of worship, that it's not only that she is saying these verses, but she is spending hours upon hours stitching every letter. She is taking her time thinking deeply about the sentiments shared in these hymns, about how even though life on this earth is incredibly difficult, heaven will be salvation and a balm. I feel that there was a form of very poignant worship happening here with Annie doing her stitching.
It seems meditative for some people who do stitch work. They've described it in the way that I describe swimming laps, that it can get rhythmic and it can be meditative for them. For other people who do crochet or embroidery, they talk about the importance of keeping their hands busy in stressful times. And so they'll want to take it to, say, a hospital waiting room. Do you feel that there was a strong mental health component to doing this?
Absolutely. Annie is one of many people who embroidered in various states of incarceration who sought out stitch specifically. And I think that indeed has to do with, you know, at the base level, you are passing the time. But more than that, it is very calming and freeing in its repetitive nature. The fact that, you know, you're counting the certain number of warp and weft threads that you have to pass over to make your cross stitch every time, it becomes very rhythmic, very soothing. I think that in addition to it being calming and a nice way to pass the time, it's also about getting into your own world. You are staring down at this piece of fabric. You don't need to pay attention to what else is happening around you. It's just you and the cloth. There's also a feeling that comes with piercing fabric with a needle. Even if many of these needles that people in various states of incarceration use are blunt, there is still an impact when you punch the needle in and out of that piece of fabric. I think that also has to do with it. This repetitive and calming thing becomes more emotive, more evocative when you remember that you actually have to make contact with the fabric every time. I also think that this was an opportunity for Annie to regain some agency. So much agency of hers was taken away that to stitch her, not her own words, because they were of course written by other people, but her own choice of words, and to stitch it with part of her own body, speaks to not only this level of kind of repentance that she is experiencing, but also this level of dedication that it becomes almost like flagellation. She is making art of her body. I think that there is so much to think about when it comes to embroidery and mental health and kind of how different people, especially those in dire circumstances, process their emotions.
I was thinking about what hair meant to 19th century people in the States and in England, and particularly during the Victorian era. There was something about hair that I'm not sure translates to modern times. Keeping the first locks that were cut from your baby or child's hair, giving a lock of your hair to a lover, keeping a lock of hair from a deceased person. There was this intimate, emotional, sentimental attachment to these particular moments when hair was kept and preserved that I don't know that we have a direct parallel to today. Do you want to talk about what hair meant in these kinds of circumstances?
Oh, absolutely. You're so right when you say that I think we have lost a bit of the understanding that Victorians had about what hair meant and how hair tied to a person and their life, and how hair was oftentimes kept at big life events, whether it's birth or death or marriage, hair was always part of it. And I think that the fact that it's Annie's hair makes it extra special to me, extra painful and provocative and poignant to me as well, that she is gone. We don't even have a photo of her we have no idea what she looks like, but we have a piece of her body that still survives. Hair is present throughout much of the history of embroidery, and I think that Annie's usage of hair is very, very typically Victorian, in that it fits well into this world of hair work, jewelry, and larger hair work pictures. And Annie's use of hair is definitely one of the sadder examples of using a part of your own body for embroidery purposes that I can think of. But she's not alone. There is a piece of embroidery from the early decades of the 18th century that's now in the collection of the Museum of London. And it's a bedsheet that has been embroidered upon it with an inscription about embroidered upon by Anna Maria Radcliffe, the Countess of Derwentwater. And she embroiders upon it an inscription that says that it was the bedsheet that her beloved husband slept under in the Tower of London as he was awaiting execution. And she embroiders it with hair. And we don't know if she embroiders it with hair in that's her own or her husband's or both. We don't know. But the fact that she uses hair is really important to note that she is commemorating the loss of her husband who was executed through this bodily material, that he is gone, but we still have this piece of hair. But hair is not just used in bad times when it comes to embroidery. There are also uses when it comes to kind of joyful occasions or moments of reflection. So there is an embroidered portrait by a woman named Maria Harvey Beale Bonnell, Mary Bonnell. I can't remember her name. She has many, many names, I won't lie. She was an Englishwoman in the late 18th century who, with her family member, made a lot of various pieces of art. There is a shellwork bouquet that's in the collection of the Victoria and Albert here in London. In the collection of the Baltimore Museum of Art is a portrait that she made of herself. And Miss Bonnell is positioned at her embroidery hoop as she is embroidering. And she uses the hair of all of her close friends, and she lists their names on the back. And so in this situation, you have hair as kind of the thing that brings together a community, the thing that gives us knowledge of what a person looked like and what she considered important, that she positioned herself embroidering in this portrait. Hair is surprisingly universal, and I feel is especially evocative because it makes so clear the connection to the human on the other side of it.
I wondered as I was reading your piece if Annie was trying to love herself because she had no lover to give a lock of her hair to. Ooh. And if she was also trying to make her own memorial piece because she's using her hair while she's embroidering about her plans for herself after death, which are to go to heaven.
That is so interesting. Two very interesting thoughts. I had not really given any thought to this idea of Annie using her own hair for herself because she doesn't have a person to give it to. I think that's a really, really interesting theory, and that it's not like she has a hair work bracelet to give to Thomas, right? Yeah, she's making it for herself. I do feel that your second theory is one I have thought about more, that she is creating a legacy for herself. She is purposefully, and I don't know what the purpose is exactly, it could be any number of things, but she is purposefully giving these objects to people. She sometimes lists who they're for in the hair work embroidery itself. She tells us this is to this person. So she, I think, is ensuring that her work, the work of her hands, outlives her. And I often wonder if this work was an attempt to add depth and variety to the sensationalizing stories of her in newspapers. I wonder if one of her many goals was to give these people something else to talk about besides her addiction. I don't know if she was doing this perhaps as a distraction from, you know, the 400 times she was arrested, or if she was leaning into that notoriety and said, yeah, I was arrested 400 times, and also I'm embroidering with my hair. The content of the embroidery itself suggests that the latter is not the case, that she actually was repenting and was incredibly mournful and desperate. But it's hard to say. It's this thing that I mentioned earlier where embroidery, frustratingly, very rarely tells us about the emotional experience of the person as they're embroidering it. We can gather hints by seeing kind of how the stitching itself is done, but that only goes so far. And it's very frustrating, but also kind of invigorating, because it makes me want to keep researching this idea that we have a lot of information about Annie, much more so than the average Victorian woman. And we even have a bit of her body, but we don't know the goal with all of these things. We don't know which of the many factors she considered when she was making these objects, and if she did indeed consider this as a kind of a legacy project, a way to outlast her short life. I have so many questions still. I hope to be able to answer some of them. I'm doing a lot of research, but I think that there will continue to be stuff that I will never be able to get a handle on, because she doesn't have a surviving diary. We don't have her inner thoughts or the intricacies of her daily life. There's just a lot I don't know.
One of her pieces is at the City of London Police Museum. I'm curious about how they interpret that.
So it's interesting you ask. I have been in touch with them recently because of something wild I read about Annie Parker in a 20th century book on samplers. And I emailed them to ask, is this legit? Have you heard anything about this? And they said, we have not heard anything about this, but we will give you the record of the object. And what I did not know until they very kindly gave me information about its accession is that it was actually given to the museum, which at that time was called the Black Museum. It's now called the Crime Museum. It seems to be known by lots of different names, and I am having trouble kind of keeping track. When it was given to the Black Museum in 1884, it was given by the Reverend J.W. Horsley, who worked at the Clerkenwell prison, and he was given the piece directly from Annie. He is listed in many newspapers as engaging with her, and that piece that she made for him is listed in a newspaper entry. I found it fascinating that this man, this reverend, gave it directly to the museum in 1884. I had no idea about that, and I don't know what the current curatorial staff at the museum think of her presence in this space. I know that the object that is there has been on display in multiple exhibitions, including one at the Museum of London. And so I think they're very interested in getting her story out there. But it is fascinating, and it gives me a lot to think about, that she is still, whether she likes it or not, tied to the penal system, and that she has been tied to it by one of the people within the penal system at the time. Itself. I think that's a really interesting kind of optic situation. I wonder what she would think of that. There's so much that I want to ask her. I think that of these, I mentioned that book that I published, Stitching Freedom, and it's just come out, so I'm thinking about it a lot. And in it, there are 12 stories of people in various states of incarceration. And I think she's the one that I think about the most. She's the one that I'm most haunted by, because her story is extreme and much better documented than many of the other stories. But the fact that she's using a product of her own body makes me feel even closer to her. I don't want to say that without addressing that me feeling close to her removes any agency from her. So I look at her only as a historian, as somebody who wants to learn more. But I think she feels so close. The information we have about her makes her feel like there's so much left to learn, that this is just the tip of the iceberg. And I really do hope that there is more left to learn, that I can find her presence elsewhere, because she's clearly lurking in the shadows of all of these various institutions. She's waiting for somebody, and hopefully that person is me, to find out what she was like beyond prison, beyond the prison cell.
We're starting to run out of time. What do you hope this episode sparks for listeners?
That's a good question. I hope that it makes people think about embroidery as something more than an art or a craft exclusively for white women of leisure to do in their homes when they're bored. I think that has been the prevailing myth about embroidery for a very long time, and that perpetuates, that's still present now. I think that oftentimes when you have newspaper articles about embroidery, the title will involve something like, "Move over, Grandma," or "Not your grandma's embroidery." It is always posed and poised as this old person craft. And I think Annie's story is a really good gateway for people to realize that embroidery is everywhere and has long been for everyone, that it's not, while most of the history is tied to privilege and leisure because that's the stuff that survives best, that is not what it's limited to. It is not limited to a specific type of person in a specific set of socioeconomic circumstances at a specific time. People have long sought out embroidery to make beautiful objects, but also to pass the time to reflect and be angry and to process their emotions and to create a lasting legacy. I'm very, very passionate about the history of embroidery because I feel that it's the history of embroidery is the history of humanity. And I hope that by telling Annie Parker's story, we can break the narrative that embroidery has only been for a select few. And I hope that if anybody has ever come across a piece of Annie Parker's embroidery on the wall of your house or somebody else's wall, that you'll let me know. That has already happened once, and it's my dream come true. And I just know that she's lurking out there, and I know that she is part of a much larger world of Victorian women whose stories deserve to be told, and who were dealt a bad hand in life, and who were victims of circumstance. And it's, I think, our job to think deeply about them, try to find more out about them, and to remember them. It's what they deserve.
Thank you so much for being here today, Dr. Isabella Rossner, and telling us about Annie Parker and taking us inside one woman's prisoner art.
Thank you so much for having me. I have loved this. Thanks for the opportunity.
I'm so glad you were here. I'm Dr. Christina Gessler, and this is The Academic Life. Please join us again.